Conference record has joined the conference.
Hi, this is Foster Guest, and we're going to get started in probably about 2 minutes. And then until that time, I'm going to mute the phone again.
This is only an hour drive for me as opposed to the 2 hour the other way, so it's much easier. And it's just the way I remember it.
Wow, it's cold in
here.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wow.
That's for sure. It's not snowing cold in here. It's slushy. It was good snow. It was okay. Let me watch.
Yeah.
Not far away.
No.
But then...
Welcome. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's good for me to be here in person for the first of the meeting. My apologies for my absence earlier, but I'm really excited to see everyone here today and to have what we have as some amazing work products in front of us to consider. Today will be where we accomplish a lot of the work product of this committee. We're going to review actual proposals and go through, discuss their merits, and decide what we want to do with them as a working group, and ultimately come up with a package to forward to the larger MRP group to consider along with our other working group. So why don't we take just a minute again to just go around the room for my benefit, introduce who you are and what your organization is. If you can start over with Peter, please.
Peter Rule, United Hospital Fund. I direct our health insurance project. Ed Hammond, School of Public Health, University of Auburn.
Dave Lehman, State Medical University, Clinical Pharmacology, and Internal Medicine.
Gene Haslund, Family Practitioner.
Kate Breslin, Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy.
Mark Gibson, the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University.
Doug DeLong, I'm an internist at Bassett Healthcare in Cooperstown and Governor Luck for the New York ACP.
George Thomas, Fellow of the American College of OBGYN and Professor of OBGYN.
I work at New York Presbyterian Office.
Hi, I'm Greg Allen. I do policy for the state's Medicaid program. Okay, so you're Boston Health.
So we're only
you're God here.
Foster Gaston, I'm the medical director in the Office of Health Insurance Program.
Good morning. Bill Gillespie, I'm a pediatrician, chief medical officer at Emory Health.
You are rating your hospital
company? Scott Braithwaite, internist, chief of the section of value comparative effectiveness at NYU.
Arnold Sassenstein, president of MetroPlus.
Bob Corwin, I'm a practicing pediatrician in Rochester, New York, and clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of Rochester. I'm here representing the American Academy of Pediatrics.
I'm Stephen Marshall, Senior Associate Dean at the College of Dental Medicine at Columbia, representing Ira Lancer.
I'm Joe Stankitis, Chief Medical Officer for the Monroe Clinic of Medical Care in Rochester, New York. I'm an internist, but I'm a clinical associate professor in family medicine at the U of R. So don't figure that.
Great.
And I do what Foster tells me to do.
Well, actually, I try to do what Foster tells me, but they don't always listen to me either. So. And who's on the phone today?
Elizabeth Benjamin from the Community Service Society.
Thank you.
And Henry, Adam Morrow, New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
Okay, great.
This is Kate Tootenbone on the Council of Children and Families.
Okay. Anyone else? Well, why don't we get started?
Great. So we've got some materials on a culture skeleton from the last few days, and there's some that you've seen yesterday, so we'll just hand it out today. I thought that we should start kind of reviewing what our charge is and what our vision is again, because we probably find that helpful for the grounding. So in the PowerPoint and up there is really kind of what we're aiming to have at the end of this process. And as Dr. Shaw said, we hope to really not only talk about some of the principles and some of the process for making this happen, but really get into some of the details of specific proposals. We have one more meeting with some time to further craft those, but we're hoping to spend the bulk of the day really kind of getting our feet wet together on what this process looks like, to dig into the evidence, to look at all the issues around. Some benefits that we talked about, some that we sort of queued up for the group to consider at least in this first run. So, you know,
goal is to have an evidence board benefit package. And those words aren't specific in that the informed part suggests a reality, which is that sometimes the evidence is really incomplete, and it's not, and it isn't in fact a sort of translation, if you will, from the evidence to the benefit. The second bullet really talks about our desire for transparency and a process. However we start out in thinking about this process, that it has input from folks sort of in the biz, within the office, that sort of do this for a living, and folks outside who may do this for a living in other places, or are experts. And that process kind of grows and is a learning process over time. Our specific mission and charge, and this does, I think, relate to the initial one, although the groups have been given the authority to kind of to mold and redo and rethink their mission and charge. We've done a little bit of that together. But our charge is to review Medicaid benefits, which we spent some of the earlier meetings doing, reviewing coverage criteria, co-payments in both fee-for-service and managed care, and specifically looking for ways to develop and promote evidence-informed cost-effective services. And the last line, probably not lost on folks in this room, deals with the reality that we had last year, the reality of this year, the reality of next year, which is the need for budget control program. And then we're hoping that the group, although it's not a mandate, but we're hoping that the group will make some specific suggestions, both about process as well as some specific new benefits, evaluate some of the existing benefits as well. We have to collectively, like other insurers, respond to the avalanche of new codes, new procedures, new requests, new potential benefits, and sift through all those, and try to make the best decision that we can about in an effort to create a value-based benefit program. So, can we just go through some of our timeline? There's, as many of you know, there's an MRT meeting in Albany tomorrow, and in that there will be some updates on the implementation of global cap and savings updates, and there are also going to be all the work group co-chairs going to be out to just present a brief update on where the group is. 10 days later, there's the final work group recommendation from a number of different work groups, the streamlining state and local responsibilities behavioral health to do. Those recommendations will be posted to the web, and there's going to be an invitation from our team members to have some comments to lead to recommendations by the end of October. On November 1st is when recommendations are due for the groups that you see up there, the state and local responsibilities, management and care implementation.
Are we this put one in this and
okay.
This way.
Get rid of the other one.
Right, thank you.
Okay. We have to go back to
give me one copy also in my, you know, I'll keep
okay.
it.
Yeah.
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 Our November 1st meeting, we have basically all of our recommendations supposed to be done and posted. And again, there may be some feedback that we received from the sort of mothership MRT meetings that occur in terms of prioritization of recommendations and so forth. Some recommendations could be potentially promoted, maybe tweaked. Others may be not advanced due to, you know, concerns by the group in the process for chewing on those and formalizing those recommendations will be discussed again at tomorrow's meeting. And then, you know, ultimately here we're looking for a final recommendation back to the governor by December 1st. So, you know, reviewing this group's charge, we're looking for basically two products. One is a list of specific recommendations, again, the adds and subtracts that we've been discussing, and the other is a sort of a formalized process going forward and potentially a set of principles to steer that.
and then put it down for the
minute.
All right. Thank you. And Arthur,
if you're on the phone with the lines, that would be very helpful. So here's where this basically lays out exactly which work groups are going to be providing comments, which time frame. You'll notice here that our basic benefit group, December 1st, we're up. We got a little bit of an early start, and then you can see that some of the other groups are reporting later on December 13th. Here's the sort of summary of the final process. We'll have a final report that would be submitted to the governor. Again, that report would be submitted from the mothership MRT. And that would inform the mid-January statutory release of the executive budget. And then in the spring, we would hold another meeting again, probably reporting out on results. This report, by the way, is the vehicle by which, if we needed to accomplish any statutory language change, the Article 7 bill could support any statute that we needed to implement any particular recommendation. So those would likely be highlighted or be included as appendices to the report, and we, staff would be working to fold those pieces where we needed statute change in the budget. Regulatory change could potentially come later, but the goal of this would be to drive some of the principles of the budget in terms of looking at Medicaid implementation and changes as recommended by the MRT, and then the ways that we would continue to measure that together. And some of this will be discussed with more specificity in tomorrow's
meeting. Can I ask a process question?
Sure.
In part because you were identifying that maybe specific proposals and things like that, is there a point in the time for scoring? Do you anticipate having DOH or Division of Budget staff engaged to kind of score anything?
Part of what we're going to go over today is, and again, it's a very preliminary set of numbers around specific proposals, and some of these numbers are larger than what the change would implement, so we would actually have to drill in a little bit together to get the actual numbers. But always, as part of the governor's budget, we would have a score sheet on specific proposals. Some of these have managed care impact and fee-for-service impact that would have to be measured. So I think we would hopefully have a preliminary sense of that impact, sort of low, medium, and high spending impact here, and then we could begin to, once that set of recommendations is concretized by this group, we would view it as our job to go back and brush this up a little bit. And definitely by the time we get to the governor's budget release, we would have a scoring for the proposals, either on an individual laid out.
Better talk louder.
So I think you may have said it when I was out. Part of what I wanted to just make sure people understood.
Can you guys speak louder?
The board is pretty tight. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. On the phone?
Yes. Could you please speak a little bit more clearly or a little bit more into if you have a mic or something?
We might want to move one of the mics over.
Okay, Greg or both.
When is the reporting deadline? November 1st or
that's
December
about
1st?
A reporting deadline.
Yeah. So we're going to get the microphone here closer. Could you re-ask your question? Sorry.
Oh, what is the reporting deadline for the basic benefit?
The report
is something about November 1st, December 1st?
It's November 1st. So we're going to need to, for the folks who are members of the group who should be able to have access and be in a talk mode, we have a number of folks on the line who I think have dialed into that line. So we're going to work on muting the line. But giving you, Elizabeth and Dr. Chung, if you're on there, giving you the number so that you can call in and participate in the conversation. Everyone else is supposed to be in a listen-only mode. So just to let you know, we're gonna mute the phone and work on giving you a different dial-in number, Elizabeth.
No worries. But I can be muted the whole time if it's too much of a hassle for you guys.
We'll do our best. And Dr. Chung, are you on the line? Okay.
And we will post this slide deck on the website. So all those deadlines and dates that we've discussed, you'll be able to see them.
They're already. This is Elizabeth. I'm sorry. They're already up. That's what I'm following.
Okay, good.
So can I get a clarification here? So we're having this meeting today, and then the final meeting for us is, I didn't see that on the, did I miss it on the timeline?
October 19th. Yeah, that wasn't on the timeline.
I think October 19th
yeah.
Final is our last meeting. Can we just go through the template? I'm sorry. Let me go get Chuck.
Okay. Just need to actually get through the template so I can read it.
Just one more thing. Can you guys just call out your slide numbers as you go along?
Yeah, no problem. So right now we're on slide 13. Apologize for that. So we have a format here that's been recommended for us to, synthesize our final comments. And at the staff level, we would take care of this, but we just want everybody to be kind of mindful of it. It's hard to see on the screen, so I'll just read this out. So each work group would be submitting its recommendations in this basic format. And we were supposed to number the recommendations, give it a short name, the program area that it would be affected, the implementation complexity, and we struggled with this before in MRT. I think that's sort of low, medium, and high. High usually meaning that you've got lots of systems challenges. You've got a beneficiary notice, which usually costs us some millions of dollars to mail out. Low complexity would be something that probably didn't involve the system. It was just a benefit change in communication to providers. Our required approval, whether or not we need federal approval and what form that would take and whether or not we can change the reg.
The leader has turned lecture on, and your line will remain muted until the conference leader unmutes your line.
Doing God's work right now.
I think this might mean everybody.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Appreciate you doing that. A description then of the proposal, our at least draft financial impact, an assessment of the health disparities impact, and then why we're doing this, the benefits of it, and then any potential concerns, and then the stakeholders that are impacted. So these are the things we probably have to be mindful of in the discussion. I think we could certainly, at the staff level, take care of actually filling these out. But at some point, we would probably want to chew at least a draft version of this together before the next meeting, so that we could all, take a look at what the drafts look like. Because this would be the way we would be advancing these to the larger MRT.
Sure. So, I mean, this one, actually, the order should be flipped. This is, I see it's sort of the face sheet. This is the summary of the final recommendation. It just recapitulates the charge of the work group, any changes that we made. So it would be the charge, as you saw initially, the mission and charge, the membership, when we met, any outside experts that we consulted with, and to date, I don't think we really have, right? We've got all the experts we need.
Yeah, we flew them in.
And a brief summary of the discussions, again, taking from the minutes. There are some brief minutes for all the meetings. And then just a summary list of the recommendations, which are articulated as just described. Are there any questions about the format or about what we need to do in terms of working on specific recommendations? Okay.
We're now on slide 15.
So we talk specifically, this is about the principles. So many of you were extremely helpful both in the previous meeting and also in the email exchanges prior to. Most of the comments I got a chance to look at and think about in this, but not all of them. There were some late-breaking comments and folks have been invited to bring up their points. The specific changes from the last draft that you saw on principles was really focused in a few areas. One was much more detail on the issue of evidence levels, which we had talked about at the last meeting. and had some chance to chew on between the last meeting and this one. Conversation about rare conditions and exceptions, which, you know, again, judging from the email traffic and conversation, this should be lively and interesting, both for principles and also for process. Issues about conflict of interest, which were raised, which I thought was a really a great point, and then the issue that came up that we talked about, which is having a process to actually evaluate the impact of decisions over time so that the sort of iterative process that I mentioned earlier in terms of our vision for what this would look like actually has information around which to change and improve. So, this, I mean, for this part of the agenda, again, hopefully you've all had a chance to look at this and consider some of the changes. We want to just open things up to discussion and comments about what you have in front of you, what the last draft was, and hoping that, that we can move towards finalizing a set of principles. So, comments, things that I didn't include that folks think should be in here, Flo?
Yeah, I had sent in a comment towards the end, I guess it must have been Monday or so. Just in the first sentence about, I just had an issue about Medicaid members being treated equitably, but it just seems that equitable to what? So my suggestion was to add something relating to, I don't remember what the wording was, but to attain the highest level of health. So kind of relating it back to health equity so that we don't lose that in the conversation. So I think Foster had actually gotten the comment, maybe many of you have, and it didn't make its way through. So it may need to be reworded. But I thought that the concept of health equity and ensuring that that's really funding to provide Medicaid beneficiaries with is an important one to capture.
And I agreed with Paloma's suggestion, and it made me think. I think it's important to kind of call out. We're talking about treated equitably without discrimination based on clinical condition, and I think it's important to explicitly call out race, ethnicity, or disability as well.
Any discussion on any of this? So moved.
Do we have a printed copy?
Anybody not have a copy? Anybody else not have copies? So I'm sorry, Phil. Your comment was that in the first line to include something about to the highest level of.
I think the actual wording was.
so that they can attain the highest level of health.
Right. Something like that. Yeah, like that.
I got the rewrite. In my last one.
Yeah, it said all Medicaid members will be treated equitably without discrimination based on clinical conditions so that they can attain the highest level of health.
I'm sorry, Kate, what is yours?
After clinical conditions, comma, race, ethnicity, or disability. Yeah, or and gender.
You mean gender or do you mean sex? Sex is the term.
And don't leave anything out, right?
Sexual orientation.
Maybe just keep it out of the screen.
Get rid of based on clinical
discrimination. Mm-hmm.
Without discrimination, so they can achieve the highest level of health. So instead of trying to specify everything, it's taken for granted.
That works.
Good. Strong and white.
I don't know. I don't. I think taking it for granted takes it for granted. I mean, I know that our friends, you know, our friends in the disability community, you know, would argue that they get left out.
The short version of this came from the CORI board. So that's where this initially came. It was short, it was to the
right.
point, passed through Congress, and seemed to work for them. I'm not saying that it has to work that way for us as well, but that's where it originated.
And I think it's a benefit review principle, right? So the principle is that we couldn't implement a benefit package change that would implement discrimination,
okay.
right?
The only risk of writing them all down, I think, is that what we
you'll
miss.
Lose something,
yeah.
right?
And we're in a principles package
right.
here, so you know, this is going to be something that's kind of a living document, so I think we may need to stay into a more generalized.
So leaving it at discrimination, period?
Without discrimination to achieve
so that
the high,
to achieve the high
so
level of health.
Yeah, I was curious about the on the second page there, some conditions for individual benefit decisions would require modification. That particular paragraph was hard for me to understand, actually. It could have been just because of I was being thick, but I would appreciate a little bit of discussion about what the intent is there and the purpose and the intent of that. So.
Well, I think this was raised by a couple of folks, and Elizabeth is one of them. And sadly, we've muted Elizabeth, so she can't speak for herself. But, you know, I think the point is a concern that rules of evidence and certain level of evidence may not apply to conditions where there just is insufficient evidence or there's emerging evidence or... you know, there are exceptions, that there are conditions of experimental and investigational therapy, compassionate use, and so on. And the ways in which this works out now, I think folks at health plans know that, you know, they have rules just like, as do we, about coverage. But there are, in some cases, sort of compassionate use waivers that are given for example, devices and so on that have yet to have FDA approval. Drugs, which they, I mean, I think that there are, right?
Yeah.
That there,
I mean, you can take care of that by having embedded into the process whatever area that would be, a panel of people that know what they're about to make a decision on. You know, know the area, whatever area that may be, and not wait weeks and weeks and weeks, but have some deadline where they say, yeah, that sounds reasonable, and yeah, that should be implemented. Or know what you know, or the evidence is there for that. I think that's where some of that can come in at.
And there are formal, I mean, there are formal appeal processes that are
right.
in statute regarding cases of experimental and investigational disputes about specific medical necessity. So I think there is, I think maybe other folks, somebody else who pointed out, mixed in our in some of the language and thinking the concepts here, both notions about creating benefit design as well as medical, making individual medical necessity decisions.
Right, right.
And they're kind of getting mixed a little bit. And this, in my mind, may have more to do with specific medical necessity decisions
yeah.
on a case-by-case basis.
But there should be a process that involves a specific issue.
Right.
And it should be embedded upon our final recommendation that says that explicitly to make sure that folks like this are, you know.
Right. So I guess two things. One is that the group thinks that there should be something that speaks to that in this document, and then second, what would be words that would be clearer and convey that?
What would be?
One concern, when you're setting a benefit design, and then you're looking at medical necessity as the exception, the decision maker would probably be the payer, which in most cases, if it's a managed care, would be the plan. The problem then is that the plan would be authorizing use of Medicaid dollars for a non-covered benefit. So I just as we're talking about it, yes, it would make sense that the decision be made as close to the care as possible, which should be the individual plan, medical team, and care management team to work with the physician to say, yes, this is not covered, but in this very small specific part, and even when we talk about, you know, putting in, you know, race and sexual orientation, it may be something that is not needed by the general population, that some very small group might need a specific test or procedure for the, in that category, and you'd make that exception. Now, how do we figure in a payer being able to use Medicaid dollars on an exception basis for something that the state has defined is not part of the Medicaid dollars? And I don't even know...
Given that there already is the appeal process.
Right. I guess I don't know if you want to put in here the allowance for that you know, that these on a case-by-case basis can be accepted and will still be considered payments under the Medicaid route, because otherwise we get into how the support and how dollars are used.
Don't you already, though, sometimes provide coverage for services that are covered by Medicaid?
Yes, we do, but we're not allowed to put them in NCORE, and it's supposed to come off the other dollars. Now, if you're a government program plan, there really aren't those other dollars. So they come off of some administrative dollars. I mean, we just can't let the person go without the therapy, and yes, they've reached the limit, but it would be, you know, it would be very poor practice to stop. So sometimes you make an exception and continue it because you don't report it to your employers and it's not part of your medical benefits. You're just doing it as a goodwill type of payment, which you don't have that much flexibility once we define specific lists, and there may be, it's very hard to predict how many exceptions to policy will come up and how many individual cases will come up, and whether you have some specific, you know, background of somebody from a certain country that has a certain familial disease that nobody else has, and, you know, something's not covered, you have to cover it.
Plus, don't you have a track record of handing these exceptions to, when Jim was doing the job, he'd get excellent XYZ number of calls in, and you've got some baseline of, I'm sure there's a track of how many of these types of things come through over the past 2 years.
They're rare. I think there is. So I would say that
they are rare.
So, Barney, your comments, I think, raise a couple of really good questions, which is who's the audience? For which organization or organizations do these principles apply to? And I had been thinking about these as principles for benefit design for the Medicaid program writ large. And some of them, maybe all of them, maybe could or should apply to what plans do as well as they think about how that benefit is articulated. I think that's a really interesting conversation to have. But I had viewed that language in this specific one having much more to do with the specific kinds of requests that David was just mentioning that we get on an infrequent basis to stretch a benefit.
The plans look to the department to help clarify the meaning of a benefit. I was more going down the path of an exception to that benefit. It's clearly defined, something is not covered. And then an exception for that policy or exception for that benefit comes up, who makes that decision? Now, it would probably be cleanest if it's hard to make that decision, but then you need to form some infrastructure to get to that decision. You don't have all the medical records.
But that's where the expert panel comes in from the right people that you selected for that specific area of interest. And most of the time, the onus, in your explanation, the onus is on that person trying to make that claim that that's going to be the thing I need. And they have the burden to prove that.
It's a hearing that goes back to the state level. So then the state will make a determination and the plan will pay for it, or the plan should make the determination and the plan pay for it.
Let me ask you a question, Arnie. As you look at that paragraph, and for you as well, Joe, and for you, Bill, does this reflect or not reflect sort of business as usual for you as a plan as you sometimes have to sort out the plans?
Well, and can I just add this? And that paragraph comes at the end of a filter. So there's a filter here that says we're going to run everything through this hierarchy of evidence, right? Then we're going to use criteria in assessing that hierarchy of evidence. And then there's this other stuff, right? I mean, I think that's what that paragraph is saying. When you get to the end of that funnel, you've got this other stuff, and that we can use a different process for studying the other stuff than we used for the things that were somewhat evidence-informed.
This was business as usual. My only thought was the very generous Medicaid benefit as defined now was presented 2 meetings ago. The exceptions will be rare and few and far between. I'm just thinking that if down the road this process leads to something that's more common, don't even want to fathom again, something that's more commonly used that will be removed from the Medicaid benefit, that might not be that rare exception, but might be the more common exception. Business as usual is fine as the way the Medicaid benefit is currently defined. I'm just thinking, and I don't know where we're going to land, something might be removed to add something to budget neutrality or budget savings that might make this a more common need. And I just, so do we want to define that group to make that decision? Do you want to just put in something that the plan can make the decision and use the use Medicaid dollars if they feel it's appropriate? But then you're losing a lot of control. But nothing is cost-based anymore. Everything's risk-based. So when the state is budget neutral, it's the plan making.
So this really was meant, I think, to capture, as you say, business as usual. It wasn't meant to restrict it. It wasn't meant to expand it. And it was, as I think of it, it was written to acknowledge that reality exists both for us, capital Medicaid, and for health plans and their decision making. As I understand it, if you think or the group thinks that this business as usual stop, or be modified, or be restricted, or be expanded, that's obviously grist for the conversation. But it was the intent of this was really just to acknowledge on paper, after, as Greg said, all the ways in which sort of the process talks about using evidence, that sometimes there are cases and exceptions in which the evidence or the process that listed before that fails for various reasons or does not apply. And I think many of us have been on one side of the coin of a situation like that, either as a provider, as payer, as program, or healthcare organization.
I think your distinction is what kind of a condition we're talking about, because 20 years ago I spent an inordinate amount of time going to court over autologous bone marrow strength plans for metastatic breast cancer. No good evidence for it, but the deal was, where it was advocating for it, kept going on and on and on, and they go to court. The judges would acknowledge, yeah, that all the evidence did not support it, yet being politicians, how can you condemn this woman to death, and therefore we're going to cover it. Whereas we've done it where, like, well, if it's not a truly, say, rare disease, I've had to deal with a kid with scleroderma who's 14 years of age and is going nowhere, in fact, downhill, and I think we made the decision to send him to Northwestern for some experimental treatments there. That I see as being the vehicle for it, but I don't want this to be a loophole where someone that wants to be the individual who's going to cure breast cancer for everybody kind of using this to then drive the truck through there and kind of be able to do it. So I think we've got to really make this clear for the rare diseases, like, for which if you don't have a good number of individuals to really run good trials because of the number.
At the risk of quoting someone I intensely like Donald Rumsfeld, but unknown unknowns.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing is, you know, we don't know what we're not going to be dealing with. You know, I mean, it's so.
It seems
I think we should make it, you know, to keep it in the family as much as possible in terms of the power or the control, if you will.
And it seems to me too that it's a more appropriate kind of decision for the state level, because we are seeking to have kind of a program that's statewide that has consistency across the state. We're, you know, we've been really moving in that direction. And I'm wondering, you know, the comments that Elizabeth Benjamin and I put into the other piece of paper might be appropriately stuck in here. It's much more brief. It says exceptions process in individual cases where a benefit would be medically necessary or appropriate, for example, rare diseases or medically unique or necessary situations, final determinations can be waived by a medical review team or other appropriate entity in the department.
The only quibble I have with that was because we changed would to may.
Right. Yeah.
And the only thing I would have is the line where it says necessary situations. Everybody defines necessary situation differently. And so that takes it out of the rare disease category and puts it into any situation
someone
thinks is necessary.
Or medical.
Isn't that
I important to call it out since we're talking about a process for what to call it out in
but
in
you're
this group.
Almost creating a separate process within the department, and you don't have the same resources with the department to do with the external appealing.
It's something that's not in the benefit package. It would be very rare for the for it to go to a similar view. If it's clearly not a covered benefit, it's defined in a set of Medicaid guidelines as it has what's covered and what's not. I don't know that it would even go to a similar view. Right? The similar view, I would think, would be more an experimental or other treatment that is potentially covered but not medically necessary, not appropriate in that case. And an argument being made why it should be provided to that individual, even though evidence shows that that individual would benefit from it, but it otherwise would normally be covered.
I think part of the concept of putting something in here, because I think that same thought, Kathy, about to some degree this is touching on external review. Why put it in here? Why create another process or another set of words about it, which would just confuse things? But I guess I'm thinking more broadly that there are potentially situations where a benefit, so God forbid, there's an outbreak of God only knows what, and the department has to make decisions about coverage of certain whatever based on a communicable disease, an outbreak, or so on. I mean, we came close to some of this with vaccine, with H1N1, and so on. I mean, this I think is trying, in my mind, is also trying to deal with a situation whereby a benefit may need to be created with unclear evidence because of an otherwise compelling situation that may not be what you had in mind or Elizabeth had in mind. And that's different than...
I agree. I
different
think
than
the protection
than
of the individual are the ones that need to be stated. In those kinds of emergency situations, all bets are off, and we will do what we need to do. So I don't think you have to have those
put
same
in
type
here.
Of protection in this process.
Right.
I think what's thorny here is the thing that's always thorny, which is when you stray from use of evidence as your criteria, then it becomes very subjective, and you have to weigh individual judgment, and you have to have that ability to do that. But I think what I like about the document to that moment is the push for let's rely on the best evidence we can, because that allows you to have objectiveness around it. So we don't end up with bone marrow transplant killing women, you know, for 20 years before we say, oh, enough is enough. And it's a thorny situation. We spend a lot of time on it, I think, because of fear that somebody's going to not get something they should have. But I think the evidence would suggest that when you have a benefit package, most that covers most things that people need, and that most people get everything that they do need in that
context. I think we have to be careful to make sure we are limiting this to rare conditions and emerging things. Go back to the second line and our principles, you know, if there are insufficient funds, we're going to make priorities. Once we make a priority out of a system, there are going to be lots of people out there that think they need a certain benefit, whether or not they do or not, whether or not evidence supports it or not. And so we're going to have to be cautious if we're going to follow principle two when we get down to this sum category. It's on how wide that window is. I think we have to be able to narrowly define that. And then we have to be able to give plans cover, because if the plans don't have the cover to be able to have somebody fall back on, we're going to be in a mess that's just going to be crazy.
So why don't we do this? We get rid of the paragraph as it's currently written in the principles document, move over the exceptions process language without exceptions process, the rest of it over here, with the two modifications you suggested,
and with
May,
and
et cetera.
So what you're saying is include the case statement and put it in here.
With the two modifications.
And would it make sense to say, for example, rare diseases or exceptional situations? Somebody said they were uncomfortable
unique,
with. Yeah.
Get rid of necessary.
Necessary situations.
Rare diseases or medically unique situations. In other words, was it May?
So. One more time to slow down. So we've removed that paragraph where it says some conditions, and we insert the paragraph in the acceptance process, which would say what?
I would eliminate an exceptions process right off and just put it in individual cases.
Yeah. Okay, what would it, in each case where benefit would be medically, we're going to keep medically necessary in there?
Maybe.
Maybe. Instead of would be.
Maybe medically necessary or appropriate.
Right.
And then, e.g., rare disease or medically unique situations.
Correct.
Final determinations can be made by a medical review team or other appropriate entity in the department.
I would just suggest that maybe you want to leave the first sentence of some conditions just because it gives it a little bit broader language when you're doing a benefit design paper, as opposed to getting right into individual cases. So it kind of gives it a little context and then just follow it right up with the recommendation. So it would read, some conditions or individual benefit decisions may require modification of rules or evidence or usual review process in individual cases where a benefit would be. And then
doesn't final determinations can be waived encompass that? I understand the context, but is this redundant then?
That's fine. Yeah, it was
I don't want to have a whole big door that people can walk through.
It was
just really just for reading purposes.
Yeah,
it sounds simple enough, at least
in
my
standpoint. But what are we waiving?
I don't understand.
The whole prior process of evidence-based decision-making with type 1 through type 5.
Right, this envisions a final determination was made. So the only issue is, did we actually make a final determination?
The other thing that worries me about using this language is that it's divorced from any reference to evidence, which is really, that's really the concept here. The concept here, is, I think, as I see it, is there's no evidence, or the evidence is really confusing, or it's emerging, whatever. So if we just stick with this language, we're talking about benefits medically necessary, appropriate, rare cases, or unique. And that's the reason why evidence should be waived, but it doesn't. But in my mind, if it's unique or rare, there can also be evidence that says don't do this. So I think that my only concern, and maybe it's implied because this comes, as you said, after a series of a process of careful attention to the evidence. But without some reference that this is in a context where the evidence. One would not expect there to be an evidence base because there's like three people on the planet that have this condition, or nobody knows what it really is, or whatever. And so I don't know if there's a way to make that a little bit clearer. And this final determination is waived.
Instead of final determination, can you use inconclusive evidence?
Yeah, you need something to say where benefit would be medically necessary, appropriate.
Wait. Do we even need to say where a benefit would be maybe medically necessary or appropriate? Can we get rid of that whole clause? Just say in individual cases, e.g., rare diseases. So because you're assuming it's appropriate suddenly, or you're giving it more credit than it obviously doesn't have.
Well, I read it. Appropriate. E.g., the rare diseases, and I think you need to put in the tagline where there is very little, if any, high levels of evidence that, for example, you have small numbers. So if you got only three individuals in the whole state that have certain conditions, there's no way you can run a randomized controlled study.
I think we've got a consensus around the table now of what we mean to say. I'd like us to just do this by email if possible and finalize the language of it rather than continuing on this point.
That makes sense, and what I heard was just that we're going to do two things to this language. One is to basically add in what Joe just said, which is that we couldn't run it through this filter because it was lacking the filter data, right? And the second was that we weren't talking about waiving anything, but we were actually talking about empowering the entity to make the decision, right? So
right.
I think we could take care of writing it in that way if everybody's okay with that.
Great. I mean, sometimes there's a time issue as well. So as I see this process, it's there's an urgent medical need that the time it takes to do a review just would be unrealistic. That's the other, I think, concept in here. I don't know if I would say it in a paragraph, but that's the other clinical situation that has arisen sometimes, right? If somebody is like
needs it now.
I think thinking about real-world examples and then using that to backtrack into the language
right.
of what we need to cover those real-world examples is going to be good.
Yeah. And I'll make one final comment about do no harm, right? Part of this is about if there isn't any evidence, then how do you know what you're recommending is actually going to help someone if you, you don't know? So it could actually harm someone. You have to be careful about the do no harm.
Which your experts would be thinking about, right?
You hope that, yeah,
because they're in the they're enacting our principles.
Great. Anything? I mean, we knew that this was going to be the tough one from the email exchange. But is there anything else on the principles that people want to say before we move on? So the benefit review process was also said that we have copies of it if folks need it. These obviously the two of these kind of go together, and some of the questions that we might need to kick around is whether we've really differentiated principles from process or kind of mix the two up, and is that okay or not okay. I can just kind of go through the highlights of this, and I honestly can't remember if people saw an earlier version of this or not. Did we send out an earlier version? Not this week, but was there one a week or two ago?
No, this is the first one I got.
First one? Okay. So we talked about this, I think, very briefly at the end of the last meeting, and we probably didn't have time to go into the details, but the notion of the process is the overview is that there's sort of a two-step process within the department in terms of reviews that includes clinicians and finance folks. And then the other concept here is that there's also, in addition to there being an internal group of clinicians within the department and whatever consultants and other information that we would require to do these reviews, that there's an external body that would also be convened as an advisory group that would meet not to make each and every decision, but to meet periodically to look at overall direction and design of benefits and to provide some specific input when on issues that are very high profile, very difficult, very challenging, very controversial, where the evidence might be very confusing and so on. That's the high-level review. There are just to call it out, there are a number of different kinds of reviews that fall under benefits that we do on a regular basis. It includes having to make decisions about new CPT and HCPCS codes every year and which ones we cover and at what level we cover them. It also includes, you know, new technology that comes to at us through other means and other mechanisms in terms of requests, either from providers or from members or from manufacturers. The first bullet really says that that most of those CPT and HCPCS review recommendations likely would not be given a comprehensive review, particularly in areas where the cost is low, there's clear no benefit, and really some of these changes for those of you that do this are really clarifications of codes or updates. So the intention here is to try to draw some line about which kinds of benefits would have a much more rigorous process and which ones would not require it. The second bullet is really steals some idea from another state in which we would ask anyone who's requesting coverage to assist us in a review of the evidence and in completing some standardized document, which would ask a series of questions describing the technology, presumed benefits and harms, what federal approvals currently exist or pending, and then describe and evaluate the quality of the evidence base with us. And that is a sort of a new concept. I don't think we've done that to date. And it's one that's worked quite well in Washington. I think I may have circulated yesterday a couple pages from CMS about that. The third bullet, and David and others, and Greg, you may have some input. It occurred to me as we were putting this together, we didn't really talk specifically about pharmacy, but there is a process in place right now. I don't know that we would upend that process.
Well, the only comments I make about that is, and this kind of jumps into the coming after following review recommendations from OHIP and no coverage and then further down, is I've always done, you know, I've served on the DOR board as well as the PT committee for 10 to 12 years, and I think that their authority needs to be enhanced rather than diminished. And I know it's tough because of legislation of prescriber for sale, legislation, language, et cetera, and fee for service historically. And I know that they're also hampered by lack of ability to have step therapy implementation, lack of ability to do many of the things that need to be done that would not just save money but actually add quality of care to patients at the same time in terms of value, that I think that this moves in that sort of direction is what I was trying to get across. At least that's the way I was reading the document.
Well, I think that the group should feel free that in the recommendations the output of this group, there may be specific recommendations that around those issues that you mentioned that you might want to propose and the group might want to talk about. I would think that's fair game as recommendations to MRT. If in the spirit of implementing and acting in line with the principles that we've agreed on and the process that we've described, if we want to empower the group to make this decisions, you know, there may be some changes in that authority or in the structure of that the group would want to recommend.
Does this document pertain to only new services or to existing services as well?
It says existing. Somebody mentioned that. Benefits or services to be reviewed will include significant existing or new technology. So I think the intention was to do existing as needed, although there's not a process, at least currently, although you may be getting there, that the department should on some regular basis review every single manifest. But generally it doesn't come up unless there's been a change or request or some issue related to how we cover things.
Part of the motivation for my question is that there are so many CPT codes and existing services. And so in addition to stating a procedure for determining how to evaluate new codes, it's probably very important from a budget consideration to determine which existing codes we would examine and which ones to examine first. So, for example, the first bullet that says reviews would not occur in situations of low cost, clear and known benefit, code clarification, or update. That excludes perhaps a minority of existing codes from review, but there still is a majority of codes, which likely would take years and millions of dollars to subject to this review process. So this document might even be more helpful if we outline which existing services we put through this process first. For example, ones which have tremendous cost to the program if they're existing, we could take through a process first, you know, focus on the top 10 or top 100 rather than have this exclusionary language.
So the exclusionary language was to say these wouldn't be given comprehensive review, not that they wouldn't be given any review. And the second line about to be reviewed would include significant existing or new technology. I think what you're suggesting is to expand or describe what we mean by significant. I certainly envision that significant could be high cost, new evidence, something emerging on the some issue that we've identified, but that could be further articulated or described. Is that
yes?
Is that where you're going?
So, for example, the top 10 or the top X expenditure items.
The other thing that feeds in perfectly into that is the emerging disease processes that new drug products are going to be coming towards. For instance, several things with pulmonary embolism and VTE and atrial fibrillation having a process in place already there to empower the OHIP to say this is going to do this, going to do this, going to do this, as opposed to waiting to get the reaction back and actually improve quality and save money at the same time. Kind of fits in exactly what you're talking about.
Foster, do you, on an annual basis, take a look at what the potential financial impact is with the revision of the from a plan perspective, we do it and we find some incredible various interest groups that are involved with the CPT program, getting in on bundling of certain procedures or changing the wording so that it broadens like how things get covered and whatever, because that can be an incredible impact in terms of cost from year to year.
Yes, but
and they could appear to be low cost items by themselves, but your volume is going to drop tremendously.
I actually had the same comment, just in regards to whether that low cost can be clarified, so will it not a cost or will it be individual service cost. And I had the same reaction that, you know, you get something that seems to be trivial on an individual patient basis, but put a lot of it together and make a significant impact. The other comment I want to make is, were really question clusters, and I realize maybe a sensitive question, is where is the intersection of public policy decisions for coverage versus pure medical necessity and evidence-based decisions? So where in this process does that fit in, if anywhere?
So, I see the medical necessity decision process as being one that relates more to individual decision-making about individual cases, and if you will, benefit, the process for benefit review and the principles and so on that we've been talking about has much more to do with policy and setting up an overall benefit. That's how I conceptualize it, but do you have a...
Well, my question...
Maybe I didn't
probably
understand
it. Probably not articulating the question differently, but let's take a particular service that, you know, what's been in the news lately about, you know, sort of transgender kinds of issues. The medical... so the evidence base and so on is really not a question. It's really more of a policy decision as to whether that's, you know, that would be a public benefit or not. Where does that level of decision making fit into this process, or is it something entirely separate? I might see the other some guy in the room who doesn't understand that.
No, it's a great question. I would tell you that I think that part of the reason why many states, and we were even having this conversation around this, is to try to take as much of the benefit conversation out of the public political realm and put it into what's the evidence say about this particular benefit or service. I mean, I think we recognize that whether it's pharmaceuticals, and David, you've been living this and on TNT and DUR, or any other service, DME or new surgical services and so on, there's advocacy and there's politics, if you will, about all of this, and that's part of what payers and states and, you know, federal government as well sort of struggle with in making these decisions. So I think the desire is to make is I don't think that any process that we create in a state agency is going to be immune from public policy, as you describe it, or politics. I'll call it out more nakedly, but I think the desire is to set up a set of ground rules and process that is, to some degree, as immunized as it could possibly be from that, understanding that it will never be perfectly so.
Take something a little less controversial, like cosmetic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the evidence base that doing procedure X to achieve result Y cosmetically is pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of this process, presumably, whatever the procedure is, it will pass muster. Where is the level of discussion that says, on a policy basis, that's something that we will provide coverage for?
So in my mind, that gets to some of the principles here, which is that Medicaid budgets are insufficient to support all potential services.
I got that.
And includes, you know, it's not saying, I mean, I think the reality is that there are, quote-unquote, medically necessary services or services that have an evidence base that aren't covered by insurance, ours or anybody else's. So I think that I see that the principles being one in which they're trying to base this on a set of finite resources to make decisions about value amongst potential services that might have some potential value in medical necessity. I don't know. Is that Greg or?
My general sense of this is that exactly what you said, Foster. We're trying to take as much of this out of the generalized conversation about adds and subtracts to the program and add some discipline to it. There's pieces, I think, on the exception process where we may not be able to do it. There's also the purview of government
to ignore what has been made a recommendation through the process, right? So I think in the end here, we'll have to try to run more of it through this process. We can't run all of it through this process, but we'll have an evidence-based or an evidence-informed decision, or we'll know that there's no evidence and we'll make a set of decisions. And there may be decisions about particular pieces that we can't run through this process, but I think at the end, we'll be better for having something standardized, right? And we'll be better for having a pre-blessed way to go and something that squares up what we're doing in fee-for-service and in managed care, what we're doing across plans, and some way to potentially make some add and subtract decisions that has a little bit more deliberation behind it and potential transparency. But I don't think it's going to be the stick that we can use to hit everything that comes at us from a coverage decision. It's just
I'm not challenging the notion that there have to be decisions made about what to cover and what not. And I certainly applaud the idea of trying to put as much as possible through this process. My question, and it really was only a question, is does there have to be some acknowledgement of the fact that there are going to be things that are going to be policy decisions that may be somewhat independent of the medical evidence? That was really the point.
I mean, the group could recommend. When we were first thinking about this group, the group could recommend a host of things that would be radical changes to current business. So the group could recommend legislation that said there's a binding group that's internal and external that sets those decisions, and the legislature and the governor can't mess with them. You could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, again, there are states that have. That have bodies that have, presumably have that degree of authority. I would guess that even in states that have legislation like that, Mark, you may know better, that the governor still can, the governor and legislature would not give up their authority to make decisions about benefits. And we may say that that is right that they don't, because that's part of the democratic process. But there is potentially, there are other states and other ways of going about, giving authority to make those decisions. What you call sort of public policy, policy decisions about what gets covered and how it gets covered, both review the evidence and also sometimes just making a call to a group that is theoretically independent, has no vested interest, there's no conflict of interest, there's nobody lobbying them. I mean, that's a choice for how the state could conduct its business, I suppose.
I would just say this, sitting in the chair of looking at what we do now, and thinking about what we could do through having this kind of an advisory capacity, and holding aside those things that maybe can't be impacted by this or are overruled by this process, which could happen at any point in this, tremendous benefit having a disciplined process with an external advisory group. We tend to actually listen to those external advisory groups. They tend to busy themselves in detail that we just don't have the horsepower to really deal with today. So I think starting the path of where we are today, which is doing what we can do, and it's not a lot, to being able to do more through a standardized process backed up by some resources to assist that group, and then maybe later looking at is there a way to make something binding. I'm guessing that that's not going to matter an awful lot, because I think in most of this, 90% of these recommendations would be forwarded into action into the benefit package or more. Because we're really, this is, I think, the direction that we want to go.
So if you were going to proceed with this advisory group, would they have to be legislated? Or?
I'm not sure
we... Even more of a credence than, well, I didn't like the people that were on it, so let's not pay attention to it. Where do you have the beef behind it?
Well, right now the beef is that it's being run through the Medicaid redesign team, and if it comes out as a Medicaid redesign team final recommendation of the governor, I'm guessing that the governor and the administration would embrace it, and we can look at whether or not we wanted to concretize it in statute, or have the governor declare it some other way. But I think it would have the full
wouldn't. I don't think so. No, I think if we put anything in the statute, it would probably be something around whatever was in the way of enacting a benefit, add or subtraction. I mean, that's the way I've been thinking about it.
Right. As our culture changes, our principles will change.
Right. But I think, I mean, the question is if the group can make a decision about whether it thinks that that should be a recommendation of the advisory group should be in statute or not. I think that there's pros and cons to doing it, and, you know, we can discuss what those pros and cons are. I certainly think that having it in statute where, you know, the Senate gets to choose to, and the stuff, you know, having lived through that horror, we wouldn't want that kind of thing. But, you know, the commissioner shall kind of legislation. But, again, I think the group can exist with or without a legislative authority, right? We can create an advisory group that can serve this function, whether it's in statute or not. And there are pluses and minuses, I think, to both sides of that.
Yeah. What do other states do?
It's all over the board. So in Oregon, which is really unique, obviously, for a number of different reasons, there's no way to bind a future legislature. So the legislature can enact something, and the next session they can unenact it or change it, modify it. So there's no way to do that. But what we've done is set up a way so that the future legislatures are boxed into the priority setting process. So if somebody gets a great idea, we should take this procedure that's not covered and make it mandatory. It goes on the list, which immediately enfranchises the folks that are going to be forced off the list by that being inserted in the zero-sum budget process that goes on. And the legislature is not anxious to do that because it makes clear the winners and losers. So, I mean, you know, for me, when I look at that and to this discussion, it seems as if we can do a good, solid process through this group and recommend a good, solid process for moving forward, then the decision about the best way to codify that, whether it's administrative rule or, you know, seeking statutory endorsement of some sort, can be made downstream. But I think getting the initial work out, something that's really solid, really defensible, that addresses the issues we've worked hard on here with principles and so on, then gives folks a much clearer, idea of what the best strategy for moving that forward for New York politically is. I think that if we kind of go at it in a stage like that, then folks that are somewhat above our pay grade can start to calculate exactly the best way to make that happen. We do them the best service by giving them the best product.
I just want to touch on Scott's point for a second, and then hopefully move on. Currently, Foster, you said that in the second line down on the first sentence, it says, includes significant existing, encompasses the review, the potential review of existing services and benefits on an ongoing basis. If you want to make it more explicit, perhaps you can add one more bullet to this list of bullets underneath that says something like, reviews of existing benefits should occur on a regular and recurrent basis based on those services of high programmatic cost, high utilization, or new or emerging evidence. Are there other things that we should add to that? That gives us cover to say, you know what, we have a new randomized trial. Should we be covering bone marrow transplant anymore? Let's look at it right away versus, you know, where do we go in this document? That spells it out pretty clearly. Instead of saying 10 or 100 services, yeah, we can keep it open at high programmatic cost.
Do you really want to have a negative comprehensive review statement in there which says that if it's low cost, we're not going to review it? Because that's your first line there. And as Joe said earlier, sometimes low cost but very highly utilized services cost you a ton of money.
We change that to low programmatic
cost. Programmatic cost. Yeah.
So that way it would
and again, don't miss comprehensive reviews. This is really, we haven't talked about resources necessary to do this yet.
I was only thinking about it from a point of view of like a Mendelian genetics chart, high cost, high utilization, low cost, low utilization, 4-point box where you basically can pick two or three of those boxes out. Your low-cost, low-utilization definitely falls off, but the other three boxes become your your targets to start looking for in terms of it, as opposed to just trying to go after one end or the other. That one kind of genetic box covers all of it.
So just to follow your thought a little bit, we had a conversation about unintended consequences. So maybe in reviewing some of the existing services, that thought could be integrated in there somehow, because you may be providing or not providing a service, and it may end up. So the example was low back pain and not treating low back pain, but did that maybe end up in a greater amount of back surgery? And just looking at it from an impact perspective.
So high utilization, newer emerging evidence, or unintended consequences. I think it's getting a little less definable, but, you know, it's nice to be explicit at some level.
How are you defining unintended consequences?
I have no idea.
Well, I'm thinking, do you want to have, you know, a periodic review of what has been done to have it become the intended or unintended consequence, and then what parameters to use? Because I'm not sure unintended consequences does anything but give us language that I'm not sure means much.
It sounds like the question, though, is part of the issue is simply cutting something in one spot doesn't ultimately, I mean, part of that question is that, okay, so you cut services in some way. In what ways have expenditures or costs of health gone up in ways that you might not be linking? I mean, that's part of it. I mean, I think Greg mentioned this at the last meeting, the issue of cutting back on limiting rehab therapies. I think there are arguments out there from folks saying, okay, that might have filled a budget hole on paper, but the expenses that we're going to incur down the line may be greater.
But isn't part of what you're talking about really doing a good fiscal analysis of the review? So a good analysis tries to look at that. And I think the concept that you recommended at the last meeting was, you know, the idea that there should be a process to actually see if it plays out that way, intended or unintended. I think I have the same question about intended consequences. Does it actually happen, right?
So, or the impact.
The impact. Yeah. So on the principles, again, whether this is something that should be on the process, not principles, I'm open to thoughts about that. But on the principles, there is a paragraph that talks about an evaluation of benefit decisions on utilization costs after decisions are made. Now, it doesn't say how often we do it or how we do it or, you know, I put in where feasible, recognizing how difficult this is. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, generally speaking, few organizations do. Not, I think, because we wouldn't like to, but just because, you know, life gets in the way. But I think it's an important concept. Which ones you should do it for? I mean, again, I think every decision in the decision-making process, in my mind, under fiscal or impact, should review sort of potential unintended consequences. But, you know.
And I worry. I mean, every day I stop by folks who talk about unintended consequences of every single decision we make. And it does. I mean, there are always someone who's going to get hurt, and we didn't want that to happen. But 90 people benefit, one person gets hurt. So there will be that. I worry about
it. I think it's more the impact. So when you're looking at things, even like the example we spoke about at the last one, the smoking cessation. So the service is provided, but nobody's using it. Isn't that something that should be looked at as an exist? So how do you build that into the language, whether it's impact or?
The critical thing, just in terms of drugs, is that there are unintended consequences that are predictably unintended. You can predict those consequences a priori and build in a system process that can prevent those from occurring at the same time. Add value to the system by both increasing quality and decreasing cost. Just by knowing how the drug is going to be used and what the drug is characteristics are.
Ed, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, one thing you could put in here would just be that there would
think since nothing has been done over time to review these things, the evidence actually may not be so new, but there may be evidence from 10 years ago that something's not the right thing to be done, the right thing, and yet we don't even, that hasn't been acted on in the last 10 years. So, I mean, it's just quibbling, but I'll just say evidence-based information that's not necessarily new or evolving.
I would want to add that if there's any changes, looking for the unintended consequences, that an evaluation needs to be done instead of really looks at the whole picture. An example might be, okay, we're not, we're just going to cover generic drugs for asthma. Okay, right now, a lot of the drugs aren't generic, so you save money because you knock down your costs. On the pharmacy side, but you've got hospitalizations going up really tremendously because the kids are out of control.
We've been through this
right,
ad nauseum,
right.
The stuff that we're doing, and had a look at the entire picture of hospitalization. It's a good example.
Right, but the thing is the same auto hold true for procedures and all
right.
The services that we have out there. It can't just be done totally in the silo because, again, you might come out. The other end with some other issues that you never looked at. So you've got to look at it in total for the expenditures for the health.
I think we'll try to encompass that in a statement that we'll add to the end. I think we'll leave new or emerging evidence new to us from the program perspective, even if it's not new out there.
It emerged in the past.
No.
Wow.
Previously
ignored. I like that.
We will be previously ignored off. And I think that we have a lot of stuff we want to get to. I was wondering if there are any other specific comments or major changes, we should bring them up now. Otherwise, we should say that this is 90% there. We'll do some wordsmithing by email.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We had proposed that language around kind of individual cases to make sure we called it out in the process part, too, that was important. So I wanted to kind of propose that also be called out in the process, that a part of the process could include a review of these rare diseases, certain exceptional cases.
Tempting because there's so much from that document that can come here and vice versa that I wonder where we should draw the line and say.
I think we're violating the KISS principle way down too far. I would be bringing it back up to a little higher level, keeping it somewhat vague, keeping the principles, process, and we're confusing the two right now.
I have two comments about the section on the other side of the page, starting with following review, recommendations from OAS clinical staff may include any existing bullets are no coverage, limited coverage, coverage without limitations, or deferred due to insufficient information. And my first comment is that I'm concerned about just expressing actions in terms of coverage, because there are other action levers such as incentives, say for example, co-payment, whether there are bonuses for reimbursement that might be worth considering as possible actions beyond the issue of covering versus no covering. The second thing I wanted to bring up is that some of the services that we review might actually be cost saving if there's greater utilization. Not many fall into that category, but some, for example, treating high blood pressure in diabetics fall into that category. And so for those very special services in which utilization may actually lower costs, we may want to have an additional category in which we do something to increase the utilization.
Absolutely. Can you give two bullets the specific language for those two?
Sure. The second or through email?
I think by email.
Okay.
We have a lot we
want
to do.
Sure.
One final question on to Kate's point about and others' point about
unintended consequences, there are silos within silos within silos when you think about unintended consequences. And I think the rehab therapy is a great one that, you know, you can do an analysis within health costs around that. You can also do an analysis in other social support costs, child protective services, and public safety costs, and so on and so forth. So just making sure that this group doesn't want to say something about beyond health system costs and want to stay focused.
Good point. I can just ask for the folks that are insurers. Does this process, is this familiar? Is this unfamiliar? How much of this process is the way in which you, describes the way in which you conduct your business, and in what ways does it not? Again, because we're...
Well, we mirror what the Blue Cross Association has, and I guess some other key principles in here besides that, and that is cost. Studies that I was done purely in an academic setting that have been translated into public findings. I mean, yeah, one center or whatever, you really have to look at critically. The other thing is that the proposed procedure, if it has the same outcome as what's the standard there right now, then what you should be paying for something that's going to cost even more in the public. Obviously, you've got all sorts of public interest, not public, but private interest in there, particularly manufacturers of all sorts of devices wanting to see it out there. And, you know, the outcomes are really no different, but they might be paid more for it. So those are like some of the items that aren't really articulated here, but it's kind of the lead question that I would approach to the new technology.
I guess more drilled down question is how do you marry clinical review with cost effectiveness or economic evaluation? How and what way do you use that external experts to help you make coverage decisions?
Well, Blue Cross has got a whole technology evaluation program with Kaiser, and we're hooked into that. So they go through an awful lot of the economics and all that. So, like the average cost per it would be this amount of money. I project it, say, over a year's time, survival rates and all that.
Mm-hmm. So, Arnie, you don't have Big Brother to rely on,
do you? I was just going to say I'd be relying on Big Brother from the government program. We do use Hayes technology for something that's pretty vague, and we want to have more of an analysis of the technology and the benefits and risks and helping make a specific clinical decision. So from the overall benefit design that's driven by the state for Medicaid that we help us check, and Medicare is a core benefit package, and then everything else is more just an add-on wherever there are dollars available to get evaluated services. It's not really removing anything, it's just adding. So we don't have an experience of setting a commercial benefit.
In our institution, we do have a process similar to this where we have a medical policy infrastructure and a new emerging technologies infrastructure. We pull in outside experts to those conversations and make the best judgment we can based on medical appropriateness, and then the next conversation becomes what we do with it within the benefit context. So we do have an ongoing review process of all existing policies and new things that come up to try to get it as current as we can.
I have a question. What happens with providers that are at full risk? Is it the expectation that they go through this process on their own, or do they
assume our medical policies is the understanding within the contract we have?
And our biggest provider is full risk, and we act as their agent doing utilization management, care management, clinical decision making. But they don't have an infrastructure, they don't have a denial and appeal process, so we do all of the back office work as their agent to help them manage it.
We call it walking in our shoes. Even if you're global risk, you're expected to walk in the plan and the shoes from the standpoint of the integrity of the process.
Well, okay, I'd like to move on to the actual package of benefits that we want to consider if we step already with the group. I know we haven't got to every comment addressed in some questions.
suppose that we can comment on fully, but this part is important. We spent time on today, and it is a big packet. So please take one of these and pass it on.
And I would just say this, that we'll get this out to the folks on the phone. We'll try to do our best to sort of read what we're talking about here. Also, I want to do a...
It was actually attached to one of the...
Yeah. Okay. There's been changes and adds to this. So this is the most recent version that we're passing out. And there's, for instance, numbers in here that weren't in the previous version. So, but I just want to do a disclaimer. One is that this is definitely a work in progress. On the last page, we have a note that the fiscals are preliminary and pending review. And a lot of that is because we've been doing this so quickly. So, for instance, some of these dollars are for larger buckets of spending than may be precisely matched to the actionable item in the procedure or service that we're talking about. We'll try to call that out. We'll get more precise estimates as we sort of move forward. I think you fairly asked for at least some background information on this. We don't have numbers for everything. We did the best we could with the time that we had. And just, you know, appreciate your patience. So please do consider this draft and an evolving document as we go through it. I just, since I'm talking, keep going here, and then Foster, you can add in. What we tried to do our best with here is to separate these into items that we thought had the highest likelihood of ending up in our sort of final recommendation set. Those are appearing on the first four pages, and then from the bottom of page four on, we've listed those things that have come in, but we think probably are going to require further review and discussion, and we certainly could demote and promote items from within this package in this meeting, but we wanted sort of at least a straw dog separation here for people to kind of beat up, and I don't know. Do you have any other framing comments that you wanted to provide? For
straw dog?
Yeah.
Straw person. But straw dogs is a movie, though.
Well, I think some people use straw dog because it's less personal.
I see. Straw dog. I've never heard
some
dog
people,
before.
Like physicians, are more okay with tearing apart people, but, you know.
All right. We're making Nero nervous.
I want to say one thing. You know, you'll see a lot of things that are on this list, and you'll say, why is this on the list? You'll see other things and say, why isn't it on the list? The point, you know, the kind of thinking that went in picking the things on this particular list were things that would provide precedent for the ongoing review that will necessarily be part of this, the benefit review work group after. So come January, February, or, you know, first quarter next year, we will have a group, hopefully, to do a review of the benefits, and they will go through this process on other things. We're trying to get a broad cross-section of the types of decisions that need to be made so that we can check off boxes. Oh, they did, this is how they thought about it when they were thinking in MRT. That's what we should use for guiding. So, you know, you won't see everything on it. You may wonder why. That's the thought behind this particular list and the order of this list.
So we did. We also did, in addition to that, tried to queue up things in the first four pages that we thought had an evidence base to talk about that had some significance, which we can discuss and debate in terms of impact and importance. And again, as a place to start, we also deliberately, as you'll see, queued up things, some of their ads and some of them are takes. Because, again, part of this is an exercise is can we as a group or we as an organization think that way, that there are some things that potentially we could or should restrict and other things that we might add. There's the budget neutrality comment, which, you know, if Jason was in the room, he'd probably be, would have emphasized early on as well, which is not to say that the group can't do whatever the group's bidding is. You all can make recommendations that go in any direction. What we would urge you to do is to think about sort of a package of ideas that are in which addition to benefits is offset by other kinds of savings. And again, savings, as people mentioned, can be not necessarily, you know, immediate, but can be savings associated with benefits. That's certainly a legitimate part of the conversation.
So how do you model this at the end of the process in terms of dollars in addition to physicians.
You mean, how would we actually do that work?
Yeah, so if we choose, if we agree on something that's not currently covered,
right,
how do you actually model that so that you stay budget neutral in the process?
Well, we'd model what the costs are and what the potential savings are. The neutrality part would be would have to do with the whole package, not necessarily with each specific proposal.
No, I know. So at the end of this whole process, there has to be some modeling based on all of our decisions.
Right. I think that's going to be with the large MRT group. We'll meet again, and we may do that modified Delphi process again of selecting based on the best estimate. Some places will have numbers from other states that are covering various things. Some places we may not have that evidence. And we're going to be as transparent as we can about our level of certainty with any given number.
And I would say this, though. We have a couple of tools to achieve balance. But I think and one of them is timing, so that if we were adding something that was expensive and subtracting something that was a little cheaper, we may be able to fast-track something and then slow down something else so that we can achieve some balance within the package. But I think basically we want this group to have some, base validity with regard to the balance, that we've got some adds and some subtractions. And then I think we could go back to the engine room and start working on sort of filling in the pluses and minuses and how they balance.
I noticed that most of the level of evidence boxes are empty, yet we just embrace principles that put level of evidence for second, third, fourth, fifth.
Scott, you're such a stickler.
is it possible that we could deliberate or focus our attention on those services which do have evidence that
it's blank does not
here.
Mean that there is an evidence.
It just means
right.
We
don't have it.
We
don't have it today, like arthroscopic surgery for me. There is evidence. But I just want to make one housekeeping note before we get really into this. Do you know what time lunch
12:30.
Is coming? 12:30. Okay, so let's get started. Let's dive as deeply as we can. We don't want your paninis to get cold. So we'll take a break at 12:15 for maybe 15 minutes or something.
12:30.
12:30,
yeah.
For 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and then get back to it. Okay.
And then we should have, mentioned the caveat on the level of evidence. Where we had it and it was easy to fill in, it's here. So those where there is some level of evidence, there may be more evidence that's not listed. Those that are blank, we may be asking many of you to help us actually fill this out.
Right. Can I go back real quick? I'm sorry. About the cost conversation and the idea that at some point when we get through all this and have things to work with, that you have the actuarial community that's going to do the validation.
Yeah.
So it's not just the clinical community, but there's actual finance and actuarial intent there.
Correct. And again, recall the recommendations and the template for the recommendations. There has to be some description of financial impact on there. So there'll have to be some degree of it. Even with the proposals that go to MRT and then MRT, there may be other work that happens past that. And the blanks, as I said, we've basically the level of evidence description that you see in the principles, we just invent them. I mean, we just propose. The staff has not yet had any experience in trying to look at the evidence and try to grade it in that fashion. So.
Okay.
So should we?
Let's go down a list from the beginning, and then we'll
yeah.
decide where we want to go with, continue down this order or otherwise.
So we can start with obesity treatment. This is the one we get asked about a lot these days, and we clearly have a lot of interest, and we may have talked about this in the previous meeting. Medicare has recently created some coverage for obesity treatment that was announced. There's a U.S. Preventive Task Force rating to intensive behavioral therapy for obesity. Clearly has costs. Presumably, what the savings are for these specific benefits, unclear. Exactly how to tailor set of benefits for obesity treatment that makes the most sense. Again, not completely clear. There may be other folks.
You're emphasizing behavioral and not drugs.
Behavioral therapy.
Correct. As long as it's nothing to do with pharmaceuticals.
question. I know the adult literature, and I would be very supportive of this. Is this meant to include pediatric population, which is a huge growing problem?
That would be part of the discussion here.
I don't know.
Because the BMIs aren't correct for children.
Yeah, I think this is focused on adults, is my impression.
I don't think the task force recommendations are for adults only, or I can't remember if it's for adults or kids. Bob, do you know whether the task force recommendations related to obesity therapy apply to kids and adolescents or not?
I don't think that they had that in initially.
Yeah.
Do we want to include that?
Of course.
Yes.
But then we have to define differently the BMI because that's a sliding percentile.
But if a large part of our motivation for endorsing this is because of the level of evidence of the United States Preventive Services Task Force rating B, it would be essential to clarify whether that rating applies to children or not before we deliberated on that decision.
I think for the purposes of today, we should talk about this as an adult proposal and that we can consider children in another step. It may be the same, it may be different, but that should be, if it's exactly the same, we don't need to have another conversation. The reality is it's probably just different. So let's talk about this first.
So how is intensive behavioral therapy defined? Who does it? What does it look like?
I think we should use the USPSTF definition, whatever that is. You can pull up, during the lunch break, we'll pull up whatever they have and we'll give some detail on it.
I think that's really important.
Back to their, whatever they use to come up with their level B grade.
Because it goes back to the, it could go back to the smoking cessation conversation,
mm-hmm.
where it's just, it's to be administered by someone who's never going to do this.
We will have it during lunch, but we haven't now, so we'll review it during lunch.
Okay.
So this is going to cost money. It could cost a lot of money. It could be a whole industry around. And is this something we want to do?
You, for just, speaking as a general intern, it's damn right it's something we want to do. I'm telling you, because the drugs for diabetes and all this other stuff, they're not that great from the standpoint. We're just not there yet with that. And I think the more we put into this type of thing, the better off we're going to be down the road. I mean,
Prevention.
So I agree. It should. But given a budget neutrality thing, I think that's why I was asking about modeling, because this clearly is going to be really beneficial long term. But when you're looking at cap now.
Well, can you pilot it? I don't know. I'm just throwing things out. Can you pilot it?
I'm assuming since there is a rating for this that they have determined that this therapy is effective in reducing obesity.
Yeah. Okay. But the ratings are immune to any cost considerations, right?
The more experienced providers, I guess if we're going to do this, we should do it right. The one that will lead to success and not just have intensive behavioral therapy. I guess once defined, there should be coverage. How are we going to find what level of coverage and when do you give up?
I would argue that anything that's United States Preventive Services Task Force A or B, we should advocate and we should have in place. I mean, for adults, there are only 20 services that meet that extremely high standard, and that's a very high bar for effectiveness.
So as Foster mentioned, should we just be looking at this for the value that the benefit can bring and leave the financial discussion out of the picture?
I
think you have to talk about money always, at least initially for this list. That's part of the point.
But the downstream effects of this, I mean, is so huge.
Check the point.
That's right. How do you know if they compare this with something that's going to save the guy from,
Yeah, but the problem with probably where there's a urgency in the sense that, okay, what are you saying in 1 year's time to offset
Your
capability to...
But what is the realistic ramp-up of such a service as well? You know, are we going to get a million of these a year? No. We're probably going to get one provider try it out in January, and then 50, and then 100, and maybe, a few hundred. And we probably can give best estimates based on our history of introducing similar types of new services on what we think our best guess.
So would it be appropriate then to have an antibiotic rather than just going across the board?
Have a what?
Right.
What was the word you said?
Higher coverage for this.
Right.
I mean, identify people who probably have a high probability of success to effectively implement this. I mean, I just don't want to see this be something, okay.
But I think USPSTF, by its very nature, has already given those characteristics, the defining characteristics of what, BMI over 30.
Well, I understand that, but I'm trying to be sensitive to Jason's needs, but he's got to go and say to the governor for our budget. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So the phase-in and pilot came up before. The way I think about that is that there are federal requirements about statewideness relative to benefits that in only certain circumstances can be waived. And they can be in the context of a specific waiver or a specific grant program. So there's a program right now around incentives to promote healthy behavior in which states can waive statewideness. And certainly within our waiver, we have coverage of nurse-family partnership, which we'll talk about, which we don't have statewide. So there's an ability to do that. Outside of that, there's very little. To date, I think there's very little flexibility for a state to just kind of experiment and have benefits in one part of the state and not without going through the Mother May I process. And then, again, you'd have to decide whether this is the one you want to do it with. You know, maybe that's appropriate for kids or adolescents where the evidence is unclear.
Filter it by need?
You can have criteria. Have clinical criteria or appropriateness criteria. Absolutely. So part of what people are getting into is the nitty-gritty of the benefit. So you say there's a benefit. All right. Who gets it? From whom? At what frequency?
Yeah.
And how many tries do you get? I mean, that's where the sausage making of creating an actual benefit from evidence happens. And there is a translation from U.S. Preventive Task Force recommendations to exactly how you describe a benefit, right?
I wanted to build upon Dr. Shah's earlier comments. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force takes into account the generalizability. So in other words, what would be the effectiveness and cost when something is rolled out beyond the initial group of service providers that are the highest skilled or highest quality. So in order to get the specific situation was examined in which there was a general rollout beyond a favored group. So while it certainly may make sense to have a gradual rollout of certain things, I don't think it would make sense for this one for that very reason.
Good point, we can always change it. If we see gaming the system or something going on, we'll catch that early on. If it's a new benefit, we'll be watching it closely. So 3 months down the line, 6 months down the line, we can always put in more parameters and start denying things if they're just not helpful or not intended.
I mean, it sounds to me like there's a conceptual, sort of a high-level, concept decision. Do we think this is a good thing to do? And it sounds like, we do. And in fact, the U.S., the task force actually recommends it for kids as well. But if you go into the details, and, we've just been skimming it a little bit, it's very clear that you have to have some parameters around it. They give you 6 to 12 months as a time frame. They give you some specifications. So using the taxonomy that you suggested earlier, it sounds to me like this would be a limited benefit, not a unrestricted benefit. And that would give you the flexibility of, tightening it up a little bit so that, the likelihood of, abuse is minimized. And does that seem reasonable to everybody?
It would be, again, interesting to understand, and maybe we'll do that in a little while, how they recommend it be implemented. So is it a physician? Is it a nurse? Is it a psychologist? Who is it? So that then we could almost define the benefit in a way that is really specific.
So here's what I would propose for that. It's likely that for a lot of these, whatever amount we get through or don't get through, we're not going to have that detail right here. But what I would say is
If there are ones that we think we want to, the group wants to pursue, what we would do between now and the next meeting is try to get all that information out so you would have a chance to review it. At the last meeting, you could sort of look through it and say, this is still, because we're not going to, I mean, there's a lot of questions that I have on all of these, and you're going to have them too as we go through here. And if we can pick out the ones that are promising, then we can focus on those and get whatever level of detail you need that's available.
So I think the takeaway is that for things that are USPSTF level A or B evidence, the short list that there is, there are a few that our existing benefit doesn't currently cover. In general, the takeaway is that we should strongly consider covering it. The devil's in the details of how we roll it out, but as a general principle, it makes sense that New York State should be following along the lines of USPSTF for level A and B.
Just to sort of overstate the obvious, however, when you're adding a benefit, there's a consideration of relative value to things that may be displaced as a result in the global budget. So, you know, as you're looking at that and you say, I mean, when we talked about the fiscal analysis that goes along with it, at some point, have to determine if, in fact, there's room for this plus everything else that evidence shows is useful, and then between those, how you might make a priority decision. So in this case, this one may be a no-brainer going forward, but there may be others where you look at them and say, well, you know, what that's going to result in is our inability to do some other things, so we have to be very careful about the way we, you know, we add those things on.
So it's 12:30. As I'm hearing the tenor of the group, this is one to pursue to get more information on, and there may also be a more general recommendation from the group about A and B recommended services, with potentially some discussion about prioritization, which we've not really talked about. But the offsetting issue and so on, I think, is part of what we're going to ask the group to do, certainly by the end of this process, is to say, here are the things that we – here's the list of things we want to move forward. Do they in some fashion balance or not? Are they neutral, at least within the context of this universe that we've created of adds and subtracts? There's obviously a bigger universe out there as well from each and every committee that is likely putting recommendations forward, that some of which may cost, some of which may save, right?
Yeah.
So
what this says, I think, can we just put in together more information with the goal of setting specific limitations and a success criteria when it should not be continued. And I don't know that the guidelines actually spell out when to stop. I think that's the important of these ones.
Just in skimming it, it's vague.
Right.
And the U.S., you know, the preventative stuff like fast forth in general doesn't get down to that level of usually. So we have to extrapolate.
If you're setting somebody's BMI is 32, and their BMI a year later is 32, and a year later is still 32, and a year later is still 32.
Right.
Well, is the therapy keeping them at 32 and preventing them from 35, or should you expect the 32 to go down to 30 if the two years have any benefit?
I think this is going to be an easier area. My guess is that many other states already cover something like this because it's USPSTF, and that we will be able to make a few phone calls to find out what worked and what didn't, and be, you know, very detailed in how we roll this particular one out. You're right in general.
So I just have a backup point back to the review process, and just in terms of when something is figured out and it's going to be approved, then what's the process to implement it? And not it's just going to be covered and it's covered, but how do you cover it so that it's effectively utilized and it has and it's effective in its outcome, and so that we're not going through a process of approving things, and then because of the way it was rolled out, it didn't make any sense in the provider community, and it's not you.
No, I think that's the point, is when we're doing new benefits or considering them, the impact should be part of that review. As we're having this conversation right now, we're doing that. And as we come up with a specific proposal, we should have metrics of success built in to the proposal.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not talking about the metrics of success necessarily, but actually thinking through how does this really play out in a practice. So next, so what are the parameters around that service in terms of who's going to provide it, how is it going to be provided, what's the scope of practice, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, and it sounds like
behind a lot of your concern, Paul, is that we've implemented things before where the bar for who can provide it is so high that people can't actually provide it at that level as an educator or things like that. And that, you know, a concern is that if the group says we want this out there, that we not add burden on the practitioner side that makes it practically not available because we picked the wrong practitioner or the wrong set of deliverables. I think, again, we probably would lean on whatever the evidence was produced on in terms of what the model is that we would fund. And then we have to, you know, think about what the workforce issues are there, how do we install it in clinics, private practices, other treatment modalities that are out there. And I think what we would take back is, okay, we got to value this thing, right? And there's some issues with that in terms of where does the BMI data come from? Is it reliable? There's pretty high prevalence. What's the uptake rate? I think those are a little bit intangible, and some of that's going to be educated guesses. I think no matter what we do, we're going to have a pretty big number on this one. So that pretty big number is going to have to, you know, somehow be accommodated for. And it may be that we say that these preventive task force ones are very, very critical. They're important. You don't have anything on the list here, department, that's big enough to take things off, but go figure it out because we really want to cover this. And we'll have to take some of that back.
Can you make this part of health homes for the first couple of years? Have federal government funding?
You know, Arnie, the wheels are turning in my head about...
So they have a pilot of saying this is a population that you want to treat.
Will they cover this as care management is a question we should take back, and we would be able to get extra resource if this was viewed as care management. The other is, can we create confines around it in terms of patients are in structures that we know that would support motivation for change, and would the Feds be open to us creating some boxes around the model, like health homes, to say, okay, now we know that you're in a structure that would support behavior change in a way that's different than just adding it a la carte to wherever it is you get care. So I think those are things that we could think about together.
Okay. Are there specialty populations that, as you subdivide this out, that have to be looked at, your diagnoses and things like that? Because clearly, you know, the ability for success is defined based upon your population, and although the preventive task force has a very clean recommendation and what to do about it, a large portion of our population is a population of specialty, and that is going to be, again, defined in the box better, because a broad recommendation here is not going to cut it in that population.
Yeah. I mean, I think this would be a good one for us to look at what some other states are doing and what their essentially their filter criteria are on the front end. But we're going to have some things available on health homes, like predictive models for future inpatient, CRG risk scores, some of which are triggered more by higher BMI. So, I mean, if there's a way for us to take this core evidence and the full price tag's too high, but we could think about some, you know, potentially high-impact populations where we could start, maybe that's another way to, you know, get to a smaller number and a higher impact on the medical equation relative to avoidable inpatient and ED.
Or alternatively, it could inspire us to look at a greater number of existing services with this rigorous lens.
Number of existing services
in other words, if we look at more existing services and ask what is the level of evidence and what is the value, there will be more potential minuses to counteract the pluses that might come with implementing all the USPSTF A's and B's.
Yep. Yeah.
Can you tie a benefit addition to a benefit deletion, such as you're adding intensive behavioral therapy, but you may want to limit drug therapy? You may want to set stricter criteria for surgical therapy. And you're going to really need obesity expert
for the person
to help you for the benefit. So you're going to set a level of criteria of who gets the surgical intervention at a higher level. Because in reality, in practice, you see individuals who have the surgery whose weight has not gone down. Because you know what makes the weight go down? Behavioral change makes the weight go down, not necessarily the surgical. So if the belief is, and I think the consensus is that behavior change is a lot worse than obesity. Why not focus the dollars there and set some roadblock towards medication therapy and surgical therapy that have not really been proven to have such positive outcomes? That's going to be a political firestorm.
When we go for bariatric surgery, insurance companies require 6 monthly visits where you have to show up in person 6 times before you can get that surgery. Now, you make it 5 times, they won't pay for the surgery. There are hard stops, and the reality is that's probably an example of too hard a stop, and there needs to be some nuance to that. I'm not saying that in principle it's not a bad idea. I think it's a great idea if you're thinking of one specific problem. Think of the adds and subtractions at the same time. I think that's a great idea. I think in this specific example, it may be very hard to do.
But the truth is, even somebody who has bariatric surgery, if they don't change their behavior and they're willing to feel sick all the time, but they keep on eating the same amount of the same food they did before, they will not lose weight.
And on the other side of the coin, the drugs, peanuts, nobody uses them, they're bad drugs. Too many side effects that are worthless, so they should be used anyway. So right, that really would be.
Find some cost savings, so it makes it meet the media to
wrap up. So what you're really suggesting is rather than approach where you so look at all the
Well, it's a systems way of looking at it, right? So you're looking at all the services that are available for obesity and then analyzing, and then you get to the unintended consequences as well.
I would agree that conceptually it makes sense, and there may be some examples in which that would be good, or we can pair things. I wouldn't limit that lens to what you guys do in the next meeting, but I think it's a thought going forward as well. Some of them may lend themselves, but I would just point out that, a couple of things about this particular example. I agree with what the commissioner said. There are national guidelines about bariatric surgery, and those are the ones we use in coverage. I don't know that we want to mess with that in this particular case, but there may be, and I don't think we got a suggestion, but I could be wrong, and it could have been buried in some of the details for a specific limitation related to bariatric in this process. Doesn't mean there isn't one somewhere. But I like the idea of it, but I wouldn't say that it's the only way in which you could make benefit decisions, but it has a certain amount of poetry to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things you can tie to. Let's weigh it back, home health for adults. If you're going, you have to participate in one to get the other, because if you're not playing with one, you're not playing with the other.
I'm worried that we'll get bogged down if we try to do that. We should, for this meeting, we're trying to get to the general principles, the precedent, like a B or A rating means we want to cover. And that's what we should focus on. We've got another 2 hours or 2.5 hours left, and we have a lot more to get through. So why don't we take a quick break for lunch, reconvene at the top of the hour sharp, and
I think we're going to hang up the phone and call you guys back.
Yep. And for Elizabeth and if Henry, if you're on, we're going to do this so that you get the right numbers and can speak. So thanks, everybody.
Oh, geez.
This is spot right for the building.
Oh, so, right.
You know what?
Yeah.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.